Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Over the last few weeks, we've reported to you the Christian expedition in the mountains in northern Iran that was led by Bob Kornuk in Colorado Springs. He runs the Base Institute down there, Bible Archaeology Search and Exploration. And he had Josh McDowell with him, among other Christian leaders. And they came back very tentatively, but with some excitement, announcing what may have been a find of the remains of Noah's Ark. Now, of course, that's exciting, but they've been very cautious. And it has been now a couple decades that Christians have been searching for a mountain that was spotted back during World War II by a man with the U.S. military named Ed Davis. And that mountain was located by a scientist just recently. And I want to introduce that scientist to you. Listeners of Bob Enyart Live will remember Ed Holroyd. Dr. Holroyd, welcome back to Bob Enyart Live.
Glad to be back here.
It's so great to have you. And we have a lot to cover because you appear at Dinosaur Ridge in Colorado once a month, showing the evidence for a young Earth there just west of downtown Denver. And you had a role to play in this recent expedition, and I'd like us to talk through that. I've recently read Bob Kornuk's book, Ark Fever, fascinating book. And Ed, you're mentioned repeatedly throughout the second half of the book. So could you tell us, what do you do with satellite remote sensing? What is your job?
Okay, my job was initially with the Bureau of Reclamation. I'm now retired from that, but they had me doing what is called remote sensing, and that is looking at the Earth from aircraft or from satellite and then analyzing the imagery to extract information. And so that gave me the skills to explore other parts of the world as well.
So you did that for?
Since 1988. Okay. So that's 18 years.
18 years. And then you've taught this
yes,
also.
Yes. Since 1999, I have taught this subject at the University of Denver and for the last 2 years at Webster University.
Okay. And so this is using satellite imagery or remote sensing to try to understand our Earth. And not only is it handy if an expedition wants to go out and search for Noah's Ark, but other Christian ministries, missionaries, needs like that, that perhaps we could get to.
Yes, there are several topics that we'll get to a little bit later. Mm-hmm. In particular, I'm working on some projects right now to help find water for people in Africa. Mm. And with remote sensing, we have some clues.
Yeah, they might walk many miles and they might have a water source closer by. Okay, so let's talk about Robert Kornuk and his effort. This book, Ark Fever, it documents 20 years or so of Bob going on these expeditions in eastern Turkey, Mount Ararat, northern Iran, looking for the remnants of Noah's Ark on a mountain. But all the while, they had wanted to find this one mountaintop described by Ed Davis. Could you tell the Ed Davis story, what it is, who he is, and why so many people have been interested in his account?
Okay, Ed Davis was working with the Army Corps of Engineers in 1943. He was stationed in Hamadan in western Iran. He was helping to build a road from the Persian Gulf up through Iran into Russia to supply the Russians in the back door in their fight against the Nazis on the Eastern Front.
Right.
While he was given, say, a week off and taken by the locals up into the mountains to see what was suggested as Noah's Ark. He had no idea what mountain he was on, and it took several days to get up there. He slept overnight in caves. He passed by some sulfur fumes mm-hmm. on the way up.
Some villages.
Yeah, some villages there, too. And
he gave the name of one city he passed by.
Qazvin. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the clues that I used to zero in on this mountain. We know that he went from Hamadan to Qazvin and from there into the mountains. Initially, Bob Cornuke was thinking he went westward to Mount Sabalon. But we searched there for a couple of years, and with everything was just a dead end in the leads. Mm-hmm. And then another guy was suggesting Mount Damavand, northeast of Tehran, which is a volcano that looks very much like Mount Ararat. But the geometry there did not match the story that Ed Davis was presenting.
In fact, some people were trying to fit Ed Davis's account and his sketches to Mount Ararat in Turkey.
That is true.
But that was just completely unworkable from the Ed Davis account.
Yes.
Isn't that true?
It did not match at all.
For example, he said he could see in the distance lights of Tehran.
Yes, that he claimed that. Turns out he did not see the lights of Tehran, but he did see some city lights. I was able to find them along the Caspian Sea on the southern edge, two particular towns there.
Okay.
Once I started working with the geometry of this particular mountain. Mm-hmm. The mountain that was successful in the finding here is northwest of Tehran, Mount Solomon. The longer name of it means the throne of Solomon. Mm. Well, Ed Davis thought he saw Noah's Ark in two pieces up there on this mountain. But the seeing conditions were very poor, cloudy, precipitation, rain, snow overnight.
Right. And what some people might not realize, at Bob and Yurt Live, we've had on four occasions, 4 years, we took 15 guys hiking up 14,000-foot mountains in Colorado. We hike in for a day, set up a base camp, leave at 4 a.m. the next morning, try to get to the summit and off by noon because that's when the lightning hits. Mm-hmm. And it's rough, and you could get into survival situations just in Colorado, never mind being in eastern Turkey with the battles that go on there, or in Iran with the hostility and then the climate and then the altitude, then the bad weather. And so people think, well, if you're there and you think you're looking at Noah's Ark, why don't you just go right up to it and bang on it? But sometimes you just can't. You barely survive just getting there. And then you get a glimpse, bad weather comes in, and it's either leave or die. So that was Ed Davis's situation. He was brought by locals to this location, and they pointed out to him what they thought was Noah's Ark. And so he did the best he could to see it through this bad weather condition.
Yeah. Thereafter, he was sort of ridiculed by his buddies for this observation. And so he just was quiet about it for 43 years. Mm. Then in 1986, down in Farmington, New Mexico, a group of ARC researchers gathered together and they debriefed him. He passed four lie detector tests just fine. And a couple of sketches were made of the layout of what he was describing. Okay. And it was this layout sketch that I used to match the geometry of this particular mountain. Mm-hmm. All the ridges, the mountains, the valleys, everything in this sketch.
Now, I've been looking through your documentation, and you have these satellite images, stereo images, contour maps. And it all gets rather sophisticated. And, you know, with the unaided eye, I asked you, oh, is that a landing strip for an airport? And yeah, that's a landing strip over there. But you've been doing this for years. You look at these maps and you get a sense of what the terrain is. It's hard for me to do that just as an amateur. But you teach this. So you can really see a map and you get a sense of where the hills and the valleys are and how it all lays out.
Yes, that's true. I definitely use the elevation data coming from various sources. And then what I really love is stereo imagery from the satellites. Mm. And there's a couple of satellites up there that will do stereo. And then I look at it in stereo and I see it all in three dimensions right
wow.
in front of my eyes.
Now, for us to understand that, in fact, this is part of the evidence that God made us. Not only do we have sight, God gave us vision systems, but he gave us two eyes. And the stereo vision gives us a 3D understanding of our environment. And if an evolutionist thinks it's difficult to describe how sight would evolve in one eye, then go ahead and add a second eye and let your vision system put the two images together. It's wildly complex. But so a satellite will take an image, and I imagine it'll wait for a few seconds till it moves, then take a second image. And so that helps you understand it in a three-dimensional
way. That is true.
Okay. And so you were searching through what area, what mountain range or ranges to try to find Ed Davis's mountain?
Okay. For Ararat, that's the traditional mountain. But the book of Genesis says that the Noah's Ark landed in the mountains, plural, of Ararat, which means a region, not any one particular mountain. Furthermore, Ararat is a young-looking volcano and could have erupted after the flood.
Which, and it doesn't have peaks all around it, as you seem to understand from Moses' account in Genesis.
Yes.
It's just a cone standing up by itself.
Yeah, it's very high and isolated.
Right.
And then Genesis 11, verse 2 says that the descendants of Noah arrived at the plain of Shinar, which is Babylon area.
From the east.
And that means the Zagros Mountains or the Elbers mountain range. Mm. So Bob Cornuke was moving over into that region and checking out stories on the ground and trying to zero in on some candidates. And it looked like the Elbers Mountains was a correct range, and that is the range that is in between the Caspian Sea and Tehran.
Okay. And so when there's a thought, perhaps the remnants of Noah's Ark might be on a certain mountaintop, I think people would imagine, well, just go up there and look. But a mountain can cover a lot of square miles.
Yes. And furthermore, there's been lots of changes since Noah's time. There's been the Ice Age. The glaciers have been up there moving things around or destroying things.
And Ice Age, not millions of years ago, but in the recent past, as we know. And so one mountain might have, let's say it's an area of 30 miles long by 20 miles wide, that would be 600 square miles. And when you hike up a mountain, you're just looking at a little sliver of that mountain. But with satellite imagery,
I can look at all of it.
You could look at all of it. Could you give us a sense of how many images did you go through in this process over what period of time?
When I finally zeroed in on this particular mountain range, I was looking at images from maybe a half dozen different satellites, different scales, different dates, some winters, but I tried to get some snow-free in the summer. It was working with these images and the elevation data.
Would it be a dozen images or 100 images?
No, it was more like half a dozen.
Half a dozen images?
Yeah.
Okay, and when you go through these, did you have any from different time frames, like from many years ago versus more recent, to see if the mountain itself changed much?
Yeah. The oldest I had was 1970, taken by the American spy satellite called Corona.
Okay.
And that was a film-based system, and that did shoot in stereo. And so I love those. Gave me some good details of 35 years ago.
So in that time, a third of a century, has this particular mountain, Solomon, has it changed much?
I could not detect any significant changes. I was looking for any, say, a remnant of an ark that had deteriorated or been burned or something like that. But everything looked like it was still, it was there 35 years ago and today as well.
So relatively stable.
Yes.
Okay, so you zeroed in on this mountain because you found features that matched. How well did they match up with the sketches from Ed Davis?
Yeah, the sketches matched fairly well in terms of the locations or the directions to various objects. What was not matching very well was the scale. That Ed Davis's mind over 43 years had shrunk the scale maybe by a factor of two.
Okay.
And then some of the cliffs were really far off. But in terms of all the directions, I was able to find all these things in the right directions on this mountain complex.
Okay. So back in 2005, the beginning of the year, you made a presentation of your findings to Robert Cornuke and others?
Yeah, to a whole team of ARC searchers.
Okay.
And
where was that?
That was down in Colorado Springs.
All right.
And I had to justify basically my findings and present all the evidence that I had at that time. Mm-hmm. And so they decided that there was sufficient evidence to do another expedition. Otherwise, they were sort of giving up on the Ed Davis story. Mm-hmm. And so they did go there in July of 2005. They went up this mountain and verified that, yes, the geometry of this mountain does match the Ed Davis sketch. Mm-hmm. And they also found an outcrop of very black rock, which is shown at the back of this Arc Fever book.
Yes, in fact, you could find this online. If you go to our website, kgov.com, we link to the photos that Robert Cornuke and Josh McDowell and others of this object they found on Ed Davis's mountain. And so go ahead, Ed. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but those photos are available at our website at kgov.com.
Yeah. And so all of our interest since then has been on this particular object. It was verified that this supposed lower or eastern object in the Davis sketch was just a lateral moraine pushed up there by the glacier. Mm-hmm. But there was one point where it did match the sketch very well, with an avalanche overshoot coming across it and the orientation of that particular part of the lateral moraine matched the sketch just right.
Okay.
Then the upper object, it looked like it was supposed to be on a high ridge. Yes, in that direction, I did see some rock patterns there with a snow and light-colored dikes that would give rectangular
cross-section impressions
that matched the orientation in the sketch.
Like an optical illusion where he might have thought he saw the arc broken in two pieces, but in fact, when Robert Cornuke went to this mountain, what he found, and I'm looking at the pictures right now, you've seen them, is rock, or what looks like black rock, that doesn't fit in with the terrain at all. And there are major chunks of this that look like, to the naked eye and to an amateur, it looks like it could be petrified wood.
Yes, that is true. And it looks like hand-hewn beams in the way that these rocks are split. Mm. I did, after the 2005 expedition, actually get to handle one of the rocks. It did look like slate, which would be a metamorphic sandstone.
So slate is not petrified wood.
No.
And if, in fact, this turns out to be all rock and slate, then that would help to falsify this thought that perhaps this is Noah's Ark.
That is true.
And right now, these samples are being tested to confirm whether or not this is petrified wood.
Yes. In the 2006 expedition, they brought back additional samples, and so I've looked at some thin sections of those, and I think I saw a table that maybe a third of or two-thirds of them showed indications of cellular structure, which would be indications of petrified wood. Mm. The analysis I have not yet seen. This is done by independent geologists.
Right. There's what looks like potentially a hewn beam with a 90-degree notch cut out of it so perfectly like a carpenter would do. We have a carpenter in our studio audience today. And he said, yeah, I'd cut it out just about like that. And so we don't know yet. But also on this mountain, they found many, not just a few. There are photographs of seashells in here and marine fossils.
Yes. The light-colored rock all around it looks to be sedimentary rock just loaded with like 1-inch or 1.5-inch diameter clamshells. These beautiful specimens. And so, yes, definitely sedimentary rock, which would be, it'll fit in with the Noah's Ark flood, of course.
Right, exactly. And then Ed Davis told the story of on his way passing some of these villages, coming across vineyards where the vines were ancient, gnarly, large, thick vines like you would put your arms around. And so that's a surprising story. Vineyards don't normally look like that. That would suggest that they were ancient. Of course, Genesis says Noah came down out of the ark and he planted a vineyard. And so Bob Cornuke said, we asked, we didn't see those vineyards, but we were told by locals of such vineyards. So that's a matter for further investigation.
Yeah. As follow-up on this, I was able to use some other satellite pictures on which I sketched in a possible travel route from Kazvin up to the summit. And analyzing from the Aster satellite, which gave me geologic information, I could see where there would be villages. I could see where there was a valley which looked like carbonate rock, limestone, in which there would be the caves he stayed in. And then he passed by a couple of white patches, hydrothermally altered rock, which would be hot springs giving off sulfur fumes. And so these are things that we needed to account for in the Ed Davis story, and yes, they are there.
Now, the claim that we found Noah's Ark is not being made by anyone involved, as far as I can tell.
No, we're only claiming that we found the Ed Davis Mountain.
Found the Ed Davis Mountain, and now further investigation. If this turns out that there's increasing evidence that this is the hull of a ship, the remnants from 5,000 years ago or so, then that's going to give real trouble to Hugh Ross and the progressive creationist reasons to believe, because they claim they believe in the Bible's creation account, but they reject a global flood.
Yeah, they believe only a local flood.
Local flood, putting a boat 13,000 feet up on a mountain, that's quite a local flood.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, it would be bizarre to build a boat and to pull all the animals onto the boat just to survive a local flood. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And that's one of the big flaws in the day-age theorist argument, that the days of the Genesis creation were really long ages. The Bible just doesn't support that view. Okay, so is there anything you'd like to add before we move on to other issues about how we can use satellite imagery to further ministry? Is there anything you'd like to add about this effort for Noah's Ark?
I think that we did find the correct mountain for the Ed Davis story. Ed Davis thought he really saw something up there. And though there are some flaws with the layout sketches, that's the way it is after 43 years of memory.
Sure.
We do think we did find an interesting object. At least Bob Cornuke found an object that I wasn't focused in on in my remote sensing search. He saw it on the ground, and that is definitely worth studying some more.
Mm-hmm. All right, and that's very exciting. And if you could, Ed Holroyd, if you can stay with us for the second half of the show, then we'll talk about other ministry opportunities with remote sensing.
Yes, that's fine.
You can do that? Okay, that's great. So I'm grateful that Dr. Holroyd could stay with us for the second half of the show, but let me especially invite you to listen to our Bible study albums, Genesis Creation, Genesis the Flood. Those are two really neat Bible study albums. And we have a book by Dr. Walt Brown called In the Beginning. It's become my favorite creation and global flood book, In the Beginning by Dr. Walt Brown. So if you're interested, call us. You can order those by phone at 1-800-8-NYART. In fact, it's the same number you could use to call into the show, 1-800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Or go online to our website, kgov.com. You could order those. And Dr. Ed Holroyd and I will be back right after this.
My name is Tom Healy. I'm 70 years old, retired federal law enforcement from Texas. When I became a Christian, I, like most Christians, was dropped into the details of the Bible, and I was confused. About 7 years ago, I tuned in about Show. He caught my interest, so I tuned in again and again. This guy made sense, and he was espousing wisdom that I knew in my heart was right. And it agreed with Scripture many times to my surprise. Bob had authored a Bible study called The Plot, an overview of the Bible, which was mentioned quite often on the show. Clergy would call and say, I've been a minister for 20 years, and after reading The Plot, I now understand the Bible. This caught my attention as I had read the Bible until I was cross-eyed. After the third clergyman called, I ordered The Plot. Hey, it had a money-back guarantee. When I finished reading it, I wanted to dance on my kitchen table. Hallelujah, God's word is now clear. To order, call 1-800-8-INYART, that's E-N-Y-A-R-T, or 1-800-836-9278, that's 1-800-836-9278, or go online at kgov.com, that's kgov.com. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Bob and Yurt Live, and in studio we have Dr. Ed Holroyd, a man of many talents, actually. Dr. Holroyd, when we conclude our discussion of remote sensing, I'd like to let the audience know about your Bible coin collection. That's just extraordinary. And if that'll be all right, in fact, you're going to be speaking at an American Numismatic Convention here in Denver in August. Yes. But first, let's continue with the remote sensing. We talked through your effort, your part, in identifying Ed Davis's mountain in the search for Noah's Ark. Could we now talk about the other projects you've been involved with, helping people in missions, people in third world countries?
Yes. One of the things I have suggested to a missionary in northern Thailand. He's working with some unreached people groups in neighboring countries, and he mentioned that there are no maps of his area. He has no idea where the villages are located and so on. And, of course, with remote sensing, I can get Landsat pictures and other satellite pictures of his areas of working, and usually not good enough to see trails, and the mm-hmm. villages are just little dots, hard to interpret.
Right.
But potentially I could be making some maps of his study areas.
That's pretty neat. Now, one of the leaders in that field is a company here locally, Space Imaging. You get some of your data from them?
They have very expensive data. They will take high-resolution pictures, which basically close up, but then they cost thousands of dollars. They recently changed their name. They were bought by a Virginia company, and now GOI is their correct name.
GOIEYE.
Yes.
Like looking at the Earth.
Yes.
So where do you get your images from if they're so expensive?
Yeah, most of the stuff I get is free. And there is a website, University of Maryland, which has Landsat pictures, both around vintage of around 1990 and then another series of around the year 2000, give or take a few years. And so that's my first look.
Now, for North America, of course, Google Earth is extraordinary, and their Google Maps.google.com. When we click, you could look at the map or look at a satellite image or superimpose both. And we look at our neighborhood, and you could see our house and our driveway.
Yes.
You could see our trampoline and the kids jumping on it in the backyard practically.
Yes, that is Google Earth is an excellent resource. It's just become available. Mm-hmm. And you can look anywhere in the world pretty much. Mm-hmm. They will use Landsat imagery as their base map. But if a different satellite company, Digital Globe, which is up in Longmont, Colorado, if they have taken high-resolution pictures of an area, those mm-hmm. pictures are now available on Google Earth. And that is what you see wow. great detail from.
That's just amazing. And the detail's better where there's more money, more of a market. Right?
Of course.
So in Denver, Colorado, you could see literally our kids' trampoline in the backyard. But when I've looked to other countries, the resolution is not nearly as good available to me online.
Yes, it's only 30-meter resolution elsewhere in the world.
As compared to 1 meter typically?
Or? Yes.
Okay. All right. So helping people find, well, maps for missionaries, what other kinds of projects?
Okay, another type of project that I'm working on, it has to do with finding water. Mm-hmm. There is a engineer who got his degree at Boulder, who then went out to Western Cameroon. But when he got there, working with a Catholic mission, he discovered there are no maps of his area.
Mm-hmm.
And for a water engineer, that's pretty poor. He doesn't have resources to work with. I sent him a GPS unit and told him to give me the coordinates of sites of interest to him. I downloaded satellite pictures, and some were in stereo. I was able to derive elevations of his study area. And from that, I could figure out water channels. And made a contour map, plotted his locations on it, and also with a satellite picture behind it, that's more detail than he'll ever have in a paper map.
Now, there's a proposal you put together for people who have a very difficult time with water in Kenya. In fact, a large refugee camp and local villages where people have to walk 7 miles or so to get water. And you found a location that might be prime for building a dam and creating a reservoir.
Yes. And I was looking at this particular town called Kakuma up in northwestern Kenya. It's in the hot lowland desert. I've been to Kenya and the highlands. That's much nicer. But this has the largest refugee camp in northern Kenya. It receives refugees from Somalia, southern Sudan, and Uganda. About 50,000 people, maybe. I don't know the exact numbers. But most of the year, they have a water shortage there. There is a intermittent stream running through the town and the territory. It does flood in April, but most of the year it is dry.
So when it floods, that water is wasted for the most part.
Yes.
It's not captured.
No. But I did find south of the town, about 5 or 6 miles, that there was a canyon that no river is flowing through. It's just sitting there empty, open at both ends. And I figured if you dropped in an earth dam at both ends, then you'll have a reservoir 2 kilometers or a mile and a half long, 150 feet deep, maybe 57,000 acre feet capacity. During the wet season, they could pump water up into this reservoir and store it for the rest of the year and just let it out through a pipe to town, which would be about 6 to 8 miles to the refugee camp.
And so you've taken this proposal you've drawn up with maps and these ideas, and you're sending them now to people in Kenya and different organizations?
Yes, I've sent it to anything I could think of, looking for somebody who would like to tie in with such a project, who has resources. So far, only two groups have responded to me. Right away, GOI, the satellite company in Thornton near Denver, has programmed their Iconos satellite to shoot that canyon in stereo 1 meter or 3 foot resolution. And that will provide a detailed topography, the shape of the earth that the engineers need to design a dam properly.
Oh, and they're doing that basically to support you. They're not selling that to you for $1,000. They're doing it because they see the humanitarian benefit that could come from it.
Yes, they're eating the cost through their PR budget.
Well, that is really neat. And that's exciting that you're using this talent, this skill, to help further ministry and basically to love our neighbor. That's what God asks us to do.
Yes. The other group is called Engineers Without Borders. They like the proposal. They're up in Loveland or Longmont, one of those towns. And they sent me a application, 18 pages worth. But the application needs lots of local information, the conditions of the people there, their attitude towards such a project and so on. I have not yet established contact with the local people to fill in those blanks. And I've written to embassies. I've written to refugee ministries, NGOs, and so on.
And one of the difficult things in helping people is that when you give them money, or even you give the money to a government, it often gets squandered and often it makes the problem worse. But when you help people with water, usable, drinkable water, water for irrigating their crops, then you've really helped them.
Yeah. So I'm excited about this project and I will keep on pursuing this until I find the right people.
All right.
Give us
the name of that city again, just and the chance that somebody listening to this might actually have some involvement or know someone there.
Yeah, Kakuma, K-A-K-U-M-A, okay. Northwestern Kenya.
All right. We're speaking with Dr. Ed Holroyd, who is a scientist in the Denver area, an expert at remote sensing. You've been teaching remote sensing at the University of Denver for some years. You helped Robert Cornuke locate the Ed Davis Mountain in the search for Noah's Ark, and you've been doing this work.
Another topic that I've been working on, I was in contact with some people who have heard stories about large, strange animals in the jungles of Africa. And when they go in and talk to the natives and show them pictures of many different types of animals, both living and extinct, they point to the pictures of the sauropod dinosaurs, like what we used to call Brontosaurus or something like that. And a few will point to a Triceratops type of animal.
And they say that they've seen some of these?
Yeah, the natives say that they have seen some of these or know about them.
What country?
For that, it could be several countries, basically the equatorial African countries where there is a good, strong rainforest.
Now, that sounds, you know, that's rather extraordinary. It sounds almost bizarre. But we do know that many creatures, we have living fossils, many creatures that scientists have said have been extinct for millions of years, have been found alive and doing rather well. So anyway, while it sounds like a stretch, you're saying there are Christians who are going to track down these stories of African natives that they think they've found some of these living dinosaurs.
Yes. And so I'm trying to help them with mapping. Again, there's not good maps of where they want to do their studies. And so with the satellite, I can create maps for them to help them with their navigation. They want to follow the rivers, but the rivers have bends and islands and all kinds of stuff and side channels. And so with the maps that I can provide from the satellite, there's much more detail there. I can even give a texture that's similar, that they'll see the trees, basically. And so I can also, and this on their latest expedition out there, they were thinking of floating down the river, but I looked at where they were going to go, and with elevation data, I found that the first half of their journey was going to be through areas with lots of rapids, possible waterfalls, and no road access. I said, as a safety officer, I don't like this at all. If you get into trouble, you're dead.
Yeah, and if anybody's done any whitewater rafting, it's a harrowing experience, and to do that where there's no help available. So, in fact, I've seen that one chart you made for them showing the elevation drop-off in the river and suggesting a starting point for their expedition.
Yeah, I suggested that they start at a place where the river becomes level, and then they get to that point and just float down the river. And they wanted to float down quietly so that they're not scaring animals with the motor of the outboard motorboat. And so that's some of the help that I can provide, maps and guidance here, and let them figure out if they can find such animals. They did not on the last expedition. I also suggested to them that if they can afford it, and they can't yet, that the modern spy satellites from the two companies here in Colorado can take pictures of such great detail that we could actually spot the animals if they are visible during the daytime at 10:30 in the morning.
Wow.
But so far, they haven't taken that option. Of course, for that, they need to tell me where to look.
Right.
Because these are expensive, a couple thousand dollars for a picture.
Now, when satellites go over a certain area, satellites either they're geostationary or they move around, right? And a satellite to broadcast TV, radio, cell phone signals, they're geostationary usually.
Yes.
Right? And do you recall any of that information? Like, are they 23,000 miles
yes.
above the Earth?
Yeah, and they just sit over the equator at one particular longitude. The other type of satellite that's used for remote sensing is in the low Earth orbit to get the best resolution. They have a period of around 90 minutes to go completely around the Earth, about 14 and a half orbits per day.
Similar to the International Space Station.
Yes, very similar. But these orbits are in a polar orbit, and it's called retrograde. It means that when they cross the equator, they're going westward slightly.
Oh.
And they have a particular tilt to the orbit, which makes them what is a technical term called sun synchronous. It is like a top will have a precession if it's off axis a little bit, and the axis of rotation changes its orientation with time. Well,
so is it normally over the part of the globe that's daylight?
It is timed such that it takes its pictures at around 10:30 in the morning,
always
for a minimum of cloudiness. Yes, and as the year progresses, the orientation of this orbit rotates such that there's complete rotation in 1 year.
And 1 year they cover the globe?
In 1 year, the plane of the orbit moves around such that it is always 10:30 in the morning when the satellite comes over.
Wow.
So a very special orbit.
And how – let's say you wanted to take a photograph of, let's say, something in Greece. And do you have a number of satellites you could choose from? Who's going to get there soonest?
Yes. Yeah. There are several satellites, different resolutions, and are available, different costs. And so you just contact the satellite company and place your order and your money, and they'll take a picture at the next opportunity.
And are they normally taking pictures anyway? And if you order it, then you get a copy. Like, do they fly over areas and not take pictures?
Most of the time, they're not taking pictures.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Because, yes, they take pictures of areas where somebody wants the picture.
Oh.
Landsat, of course, is taking pictures all over the place, but it takes 16 days or so for it to come back to the same area and take a picture again. And then cloud cover is an issue. And there's lots of archive pictures, basically pictures that have been taken of an area, and those are usually less cost than one you want right now.
Mm. Google's photographs of Arvada, Colorado are about 3 or 4 years old.
Yes.
And so I imagine eventually they'll update them.
Yeah, I think March 23rd, 2003 or something like that is the vintage of the high-resolution pictures of the Denver area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is an example of what a Christian could do, taking their talent, their skill, what they've learned, and then using this for ministry in a lot of behind-the-scenes ways. That's mostly a lot of work, but once in a while, if you make yourself available to ministry, sometimes you could be involved with something pretty exciting.
Yes. Do I like to be of service? And here the Lord's given me some special skills, which I didn't have before. And so I try to use them for useful things for the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. That is exciting. Now, how about your coin collection?
Okay. Back in, I inherited coins from both grandfathers. And one of the grandfathers worked for a museum in Rochester, New York, and had access to ancient coins, like the Roman period, for example. And I inherited a few coins from that period. That let me know that they were out there. But it wasn't a great number. Then around 1980, I felt led of the Lord to get things like I didn't have, like a widow's mite or a shekel. And I found
coins named in the Bible that you can purchase. You could go to a numismatic convention and purchase them because, in fact, they were minted and they're normally buried somewhere. And some archaeologist comes across them in a dig and then that they go on sale.
Yes. So, I get mine from mail-order coin dealers. There's a couple dozen around the country that are reputable. I don't buy investment-grade quality. I just buy something that is readable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I figured out I could get these coins from mail-order coin dealers, and then within 3 years, the whole thing escalated to a large exhibit, which now covers 3 8-foot tables with explanations, each coin in a Ziploc bag with a paper describing what the coin is about and how it relates to biblical themes or Christian themes.
Wow. And I know we've discussed trying to get your exhibit to Maranatha Christian Center. That's where our church, Denver Bible Church, meets.
Yeah, and it actually has been there a few times in the past.
It has been there, and we're hoping to get it there again because this helps people connect with the historicity of the Bible, that the Bible is not a book of myths, but these stories are rooted in history.
Yes, the coins verify that the history of the Bible is real history. It's not fairy tales. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why I have these in plastic Ziploc bags just lying on the table so that people can pick them up and have the physical contact right in their hands from 2,000 years ago.
And when people read the Book of Mormon, there are references in that book Joseph Smith wrote of numerical values or monetary values, but archaeologists have never come across those monetary values anywhere other than but in his book.
Yes, Alma chapter 11, I think it is 11 or 13, but I think it's 11, lists an elaborate coinage system. In fact, the header on that chapter says Nephite coins. Now, when pressed, the Mormons will come back and say, well, the Nephite coins is not part of the inspired text. And maybe it was just bags of silver and bags of gold or something like that.
Right.
But they're just trying to wiggle out of it.
But no such minted coins from this supposed empire. The Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith suggested that Jews back in the Old Testament time came across the Atlantic in ships and established an empire here, and that the American Indians are really Jews from the Old Testament. And that story is simply historically false.
Yes.
The American Indians, genetically now, the science of DNA is helping us trace people. And they're Hamitic. They're Asiatic. They're not Semitic. They're not Jewish.
Yeah, closest connection that I've seen recently is like Mongolia. In fact, the Mongolians will treat the Navajos as brothers.
Mm. And that, of course, is fascinating. And we notice specifically that American Indians do not have Jewish practices like circumcision or keeping the Sabbath or the dietary law, whereas there's a tribe of blacks in Africa, the Lembas, and they have this ancient tradition that they're Jewish. And it turns out that they circumcise and they keep the Sabbath and the dietary laws. And scientists have been able to find genetic markers that they share with Jews, which is fascinating. And it tells us that the Israelites had some relations with blacks in Africa, and that has survived for thousands of years. But this story that American Indians are actually Jews, which the entire Book of Mormon is based on that fundamental claim, that is false genetically. And by the way, Dr. Ed Holroyd can show you that you can build a collection of every coin mentioned in the Bible, but the coins and the monetary values mentioned in the Book of Mormon never existed. And in fact, you can find no reference to them in the history of the world.
That's true. I make a claim in my exhibit that there is no country that has ever minted coins only to have every last one vanish, that some of them are always found under a stone, cracks in the earth, down a well or wherever, and eventually they're found. And another point is that, say, the cities in the Book of Mormon are also fictitious. I have asked the people, where would I go to visit the ruins of Zarahemla? Now, that's the logic, same logic as where would I go in Europe to find the ruins of Sleeping Beauty's castle? There are plenty of castles in Europe.
But not Sleeping Beauty's.
No.
But if you want to find the ruins of Jericho, or the ruins of Ur of the Chaldees, Abraham's birthplace, you can go and find them because they're historical.
Yeah, and I've been to several of the historical sites.
Now, there's a Christian university, CCU, Colorado Christian University, and your coin collection, people can see it online.
Yes, they can.
At ccu.edu/biblicalcoins.
Yes, biblical coins, all as one word.
So ccu.edu, that's a normal extension for an educational website, ccu.edu/biblicalcoins, and there you are.
Yes.
And it's a neat collection.
Yes, it's been on the air there since 1999. and people all over the world can look at it. And I have the physical exhibit that looks the same way, and that physical exhibit has now been to five continents, sometimes without me.
Now, that's also extraordinary that your collection travels. And, well, coming up in Denver, there's the Denver World's Fair of Money coming up in just a few weeks. And you'll be speaking there, giving a presentation?
Yes, on Thursday at 1 o'clock, I will be given a room there in which I will speak for 45 minutes, basically summarizing this webpage, A Collection of Coins.
This is Thursday, August 17th at 1 in the afternoon at the Denver Convention Center. It's put on by the American Numismatic Association. And so what will your presentation be?
Okay, I've given it the topic, Making the Bible Real Through Coins. Summarizing my experiences with the physical exhibit and with the website that I'm showing that the Bible is really talking about real history. And if you can trust the history behind the Bible in every point, then the rest of it is probably trustworthy also.
Wow, that's really exciting. So it's not just satellite imagery, but it's apologetics. It's gathering evidence to show people that the story of the Bible is trustworthy.
Yes.
And that's ultimately because of our Creator God. The Bible is God's Word.
Yes. And He has told us what He has done.
That He created the earth and the universe, and He put man on it. But we really mess things up quite a bit.
Yes, our sin has given us false perceptions and made us go off on our own tangents and basically run away from what He originally intended. And mm-hmm. There's been severe consequences.
Yeah, so we see the suffering in the world all around us. And when people don't really care, it seems like that's all that evil men need to for them to succeed is for most people to not care. But God calls us not to be apathetic, but to love your neighbor. And we have this message. It's sort of like the world's best-kept secret that Jesus Christ loves us and He's died for us and He wants to forgive us if only we will trust Him.
Agree highly.
Yeah. So it's sad that some people look at Jesus Christ and they conclude that He's not worth their trust. And that just blows my mind. When people, even people who believe the Bible is God's word and they accept Christianity generally, but they don't commit their lives to Him. And so they look at Jesus Christ and they say, you know, He's not really worthy of my trust. I'm going to live my life on my own and pretty much ignore God. And that's just so devastating.
Yeah. But here we preach that God has visited us as Jesus Christ, the creator of the world, comes down in human form to live amongst us for a while. And not only that, the Old Testament shows that He dropped in on us many times in the past.
Right.
And just checking up on His people and His creation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very personal God, not a remote God.
And so the Bible tells the story of creation, and it gives details that we can then check with science. And that the world was covered in a global flood. And it turns out the continents are buried in about a mile deep of sedimentary layers. And there's billions of dead things that have been laid down in water buried in these sediments all over the earth. That's a pretty good chunk of evidence for the Bible's claim that the earth was covered in a global flood.
Yeah, and if you leveled the rock, then the water would cover the earth to about 2 miles deep. Mm. We have that much water out there already.
Yeah, people say, where did the water go to? Well, look at the oceans. And the earth, while we're covered in two-thirds of the earth, is ocean, covered in water, and Mars is dry as a bone. And you have atheists saying, well, Mars was once covered in water, but they deny that the earth could have been, which is just hysterical. So, Dr. Ed Holroyd, we're about out of time. You'll be at Dinosaur Ridge first Saturday of the month?
Yes, I will.
All right. Well,
God willing, of course.
God willing. And my son, Zachary, and I went there and saw you about a month ago. That was great. So thank you for joining us here at Bob and Your Live.
Glad to be back.
It's been an honor with Dr. Ed Holroyd. And tune in to our next show. God bless you. This is Bob and Your Live.